found that the genes that were inserted into soybeans transferred into the DNA of the bacteria living inside us, and certain varieties of genetically modified corn are engineered to produce an insecticide living inside us.
I'm looking at the food that's in the grocery store. They say it's safe, everybody eat more. On second thought, I don't really know if it's made with those GMOs. So I'm looking for the non-GMO label before I bring it home and put it on a table.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Frederick Kaufman, a contributing editor at Harper's and a professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's written about American food culture for foreign policy, Wired, The New Yorker, Gourmet, and The New York Times Magazine, and has spoken about food justice and food politics at the General Assembly of the United Nations. His latest book is Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frederick Kaufman.
Thank you, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And I want some answers here. I think our audience do, too. Why is our food getting less healthy, has less taste, and is more expensive?
Well, I think that is the question on everybody's minds, and that was the question that was on my mind. And when I went out to try and find the answer, I was just shocked to discover again and again all the ways that food has stopped being food. That's the subtitle of my book, How Food Stopped Being Food. And food has become a political football, it's become a legal construct, it's become a patent right, and ultimately it's become a plaything for Wall Street. And in all of these ways, food has stopped being delicious and healthy and inexpensive and affordable for everyone on earth. We got a real problem here.
Well, Frederick, then explain this connection between the hidden connection between global food and global finance.
Well, I was shocked to discover what really got me going on this was the year 2008, about 5 years ago. And that was the year that the Earth saw the greatest wheat harvest in the history of wheat harvests on Earth. Yet in that same year, Ian, more than 200 million people kind of went from lower middle class status, and they sunk rapidly into the ranks of the global hungry. And all of a sudden in that year, if you can believe it, we had almost a billion hungry people on Earth. And I started trying to figure out why, when we had so much wheat, why, when we had so much food, were so many people going hungry. And I realized a very simple truth, which is that people don't go hungry because there's not enough food. People go hungry because they can't afford the price of food, and something was pushing that price up into the stratosphere. The price of food has, in the past 10 years, doubled and tripled, and it shows no sign of going back to where it was back in 2003.
And that's because it is being gamed at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Isn't that the answer?
Well, that is what that's where my research led me. I mean, ultimately, I ended up on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and at the offices of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, and I realized that for some of the greatest financial forces on Earth, food has stopped being food. Food is a investment. It's a financial plaything. And they had created these new investment vehicles, which made it possible to bet on the price of food and drew in a lot of new investors. And when I mean a lot of new investors, I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars worth of new investors. Really in a matter of months at certain periods of time in these critical periods, that is 2008, 2010, and 2011, when again the price of food skyrocketed.
By the way, this happened.
That is what happened.
Sure, but what happened concurrently? You can bet the farm on this, Frederick. The price of gas also went up. It's the same mechanism that gains.
Not only the price of gas, but the price of gold. What this shows us is that the entire suite of commodities. I mean, if we can talk for a second, what's a commodity? We say, you know, the standard commodities are the precious metals: silver, platinum, gold. The energies: jet fuel, car fuel, oil, and the agriculturals, right? The beef and the pork and the wheat and the soy and the corn. And that's right. All of these commodities have been, and it's a funny term, we might want to explain it, they've been financialized. There's so much money pouring in, there are so many people betting on this, that actually there's been a what's called a demand shock to the system. People are betting on this price of food and wanting to bet so much on the price of food that they're actually driving it higher and higher, all the commodities as a suite. It's a big problem, particularly since we can't eat gold and we can't eat jet fuel, but we do need our daily bread.
Well, that's what's interesting about the pushback from the American Bakers Association, who've signed on to an amicus brief to support this idea of having position limits on these index funds that Goldman Sachs came up with, which are traded in the wheat market. It's the same that goes on in the gasoline market. And, you know, commodities markets are supposed to be there to give stability to the end user. If you're an airline, you want to know that in years' time, jet fuel is going to be affordable. And if you're a baker, if you're Pillsbury or some big company, you want to know what the price of wheat's going to be next year. So, what do you make of the American Bankers Association stepping in here?
Well, look, these commodity markets worked very well for about 100 years in this country. We had a stable price of food, and you're absolutely right, Ian. I should have you go on tour with me. That's absolutely right, which is the quote-unquote bona fide hedgers in this market, the bakers and the farmers. They need to understand, and they use these commodities markets to discover the price and to manage their risks going forward. Well, what happened is that Goldman and J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank and Barclays, they saw a weakness in this market, and they exploited it and made the markets no longer what's called symmetrical. They made them asymmetrical. They cooed the market. They made a little coup, and they started extracting billions of dollars worth of profits for themselves by driving up the price of food. It's a rather complicated thing they did. And you're right, it's called the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index is really what started it all. But really what started it all is the whole notion that banks can take as big a stake as they like in our daily bread, in food. That was not always the case. For most of the 20th century, banks were limited. They were regulated. They said, if you're not a quote-unquote bona fide hedger, if you're not a farmer or a baker, a Pillsbury, or even a Pepsi or a McDonald's, you can't bet the farm on food. However, in the late 1990s, the secret position limit exemptions were snuck in at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. It's a very dark part of the past history of commodities that these exemptions were given to Goldman, to J.P. Morgan Chase, all of a sudden saying to them, you can play for as high stakes as you like in global food markets. And we are still vulnerable, Ian, although we had legislation, Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform, specifically asking the CFTC to demand position limits. They were sued by the Derivatives Association. And so far, none of this legislation that was passed by Dodd-Frank has actually been able to become law. We are still as vulnerable as we were in 2008 when the price of global wheat quadrupled. We're still as vulnerable as we were in 2010, 2011 when we went even higher. And of course, this is not just a problem for America, where we have more people on food stamps, where we have hunger in this country. It really writes itself large all over the world in the global hunger numbers and an increasing political instability that always comes back to bite us in the rear end.
Again, I'm speaking with Frederick Kaufman, a contributing editor at Harper's and professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's written about American food culture for Foreign Policy, Wired, The New Yorker, Gourmet, The New York Times Magazine, and has spoken about food justice and food politics at the General Assembly of the United Nations. His latest book is Beth the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. And in terms of food justice and food politics, given that you spoke at the General Assembly, you know, these events that you mentioned in the market where there's a surplus of wheat and yet people are starving, that in part led to the Arab Spring, did it not?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that if you would like to foster political instability in a country, the best way to do it is food inflation. And what we saw during Egypt, and we saw really across northern Africa and into the Middle East during the period of the Arab Spring, was food inflation running at about 40% higher than headline inflation. food inflation going completely out of control. We can see it now, Ian. We can see it now, obviously, in Syria, but even more, we can see it in Iran. There's a very strong push to increase food inflation in Iran for the express purposes of trying to foster regime change there. Now, you might think, maybe that's a good thing for Iran. Maybe we need regime change. Well, I guess you would agree then with the CIA and all the people who are working very hard on foreign policy to try to increase food inflation in those countries, because that is what is going to cause regime change. What's interesting about it is that, for instance, our old friend Paul Ryan, when he was considering really insisting on cutting entitlement programs for food stamps in this country, I thought it was such a really sick irony, because if you really want to screw up a country, if you really want to cause regime change, that's just what you do. In times of rising food prices, you cut the subsidies and food entitlement programs. So that's why I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post saying Paul Ryan is Al-Qaeda's best friend.
Well, you know, of course, we've tried sanctions against Castro.
Yeah.
How long's that been going on for?
Well, Cuba actually figured out a very interesting way of guaranteeing their own food security and really stabilizing the price of their food. So despite our embargo and our sanctions, they have been able to take care of themselves. Now, I would not want to be a Cuban today. They do not eat as well as we do. No question.
Well, that's the joke in Cuba. The successes of the revolution are sports, medicine, and education. The failures of the revolution are breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit, because I've only got a few minutes left here, and I wanted to talk to you, because I mentioned in the opening, Frederick Kaufman, about how we recently saw this extraordinary display of political muscle where Monsanto were able to get the Congress to essentially shut down the judicial branch of government and prevent any lawsuits against their GMO products, these genetic...
This is such an outrage. It's just so extraordinary. I think a lot of the rage and distrust of genetically modified organisms in our food stream really is a misplaced hatred, for very good reason, of Monsanto, who are very, very bad players here. What they have done is they have patented and now own as their own intellectual property huge swaths of the global food system. Now, just think for a second. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, going back to Cuba. You know, everybody needs to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. This is what's called an inelastic market. There is a demand for 2,000 calories or so every day. We're all in this market. It is a natural phenomenon. We can't get out of it. Now, what are some other natural things we do every day, Ian, like sleeping? Can you imagine if Monsanto earned their rent on sleep? Well, that's what they're doing, is they're earning their rent on food. Imagine if they had, figured out, well, we're going to patent sex. Every time you have sex, we're going to get a little money on it. That's exactly what they've done with our food source. Every time we eat wheat and bread and soy, well, 80% of it is their soy, is their GMO soy, and they're earning rent on it. It's their intellectual property, and it's just outrageous, the political capture and the market capture that they've done in Washington. It's just extraordinary. These are foodopolists at their worst.
So they're the Viagra of the food chain.
That's what I would say. Except, remember, I'm arguing in a piece in Slate soon that really the way to get Monsanto out of the business is to take a lesson from open source software. The lessons of Wikipedia are the ways to get Monsanto out. What do I mean by this? Open source GMO. In other words, the reason they make their money, the way they make their money, is through their patents, their utility patents on pesticide, their patents on seeds. Well, let's say we said, you actually can't patent life like this, like the Human Genome Project. That's all free. It's all open source. If we were to make genetic modification open source, Monsanto would be out of the business so fast, because there'd be no more money in it for them.
Well, I did an interview recently with a scholar who'd done some research on researchers who had tried to look into the effects of GMO foods, but with lab rats and others, and they found that these lab rats developed tumors and all kinds of horrible effects from eating GMO food. And they've been systematically shut down by Monsanto. So I don't understand why it has the power. It seems to have unlimited political and judicial power.
Look, I think that what we're seeing here is GMO soy and GMO wheat, and not GMO wheat, GMO corn. They haven't done the wheat yet. They're getting close to the genome. And we're looking at about 80% and upwards of our corn and soy supply being genetically modified. Now, on the one hand, you can say, well, look, this is the greatest public health experiment in the history of the world. Every single Snickers bar, all the lecithin in Hershey's, all of this stuff has relationship to GMO soy or corn. So, and you could say, and nobody's been getting sick. Nobody's dying because of this. This is the argument that Monsanto is using. They're saying, look, stop the hysteria. People are eating this. People are okay. And that gives them carte blanche to continue their monopolistic and bad practices across the board, which ruin farmers. And so what I've been arguing for in Bet the Farm, How Food Stops Being Food, what I've been saying is the way to get them out is to trip them up at the knees on the level of their income stream and their money. And so that's why I'm arguing for a complete reform of patent laws. Did you know there's a plant patent law from 1930, which allows people to have plants as their intellectual property? Well, that law is really being abused and exploited by the likes of Monsanto. And I think if we can do some reform on the patent end, and I think if we can consider our daily bread as an open source, as it has been for 10,000 years, we would go a long way to get them out of the business. You know, cooking is open source. Your mother teaches it to you. Your father teaches it to you. You go to a restaurant. Chefs are always creating more intellectual property intellectual capacity without the intellectual property laws.
So,
you know, the way this business has always worked.
Well, Frederick, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your insight here.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Frederick Kaufman, who's a contributing editor at Harper's and a professor at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. He's written about American food culture for Foreign Policy, Wired, The New Yorker, Gourmet, The New York Times Magazine, and has spoken about food justice and food politics at the General Assembly of the United Nations. His latest book is Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again at Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.